She blurted out the first words which came to her lips. Mistress? What would I get out of that except a passel of brats? And then her jaw dropped in horror as she realized what she had said. He laughed until he choked, peering at her in the shadows as she sat, stricken dumb, pressing her handkerchief to her mouth. That's why I like you. You are the only frank woman I know, the only woman who looks on the practical side of matters without beclouding the issue with mouthings about sin and morality. Any other woman would have swooned first, and then shown me the door. Scarlet leaped to her feet, her face red with shame. How could she have said such a thing? How could she, Ellen's daughter, with her upbringing, have sat there and listened to such debasing words and then made such a shameless reply? She should have screamed. She should have fainted. She should have turned coldly away in silence and swept from the porch. Too late now. I will show you the door, she shouted, not caring if Melanie or the Meads down the street did hear her. Get out! How dare you say such things to me? What have I ever done to encourage you, to make you suppose... Get out, and don't ever come back here. I mean it this time. Don't you ever come back here with any of your piddling papers of pins and ribbons, thinking I'll forgive you. I'll tell my father, and he'll kill you. He picked up his hat and bowed. And she saw in the light of the lamp that his teeth were showing in a smile beneath his mustache. He was not ashamed. He was amused at what she had said, and he was watching her with alert interest. Oh, he was detestable! She swung round on her heel and marched into the house. She grabbed hold of the door to shut it with a bang, but the hook, which held it open, was too heavy for her. She struggled with it, panting.
May I help you? He asked.
Feeling that she would burst a blood vessel if she stayed another minute, she stormed up the stairs. And as she reached the upper floor, she heard him obligingly slam the door for her. Chapter 20. As the hot, noisy days of August were drawing to a close, the bombardment abruptly ceased. The quiet that fell on the town was startling. Neighbors met on the streets and stared at one another, uncertain, uneasy as to what might be impending. The stillness, after the screaming days, brought no surcease to strained nerves, but, if possible, made the strain even worse. No one knew why the Yankee batteries were silent. There was no news of the troops, except that they had been withdrawn in large numbers from the breastworks about the town and had marched off toward the south to defend the railroad. No one knew where the fighting was, if indeed there was any fighting, or how the battle was going, if there was a battle. Nowadays, the only news was that which passed from mouth to mouth. Short of paper, short of ink, short of men, the newspapers had suspended publication after the siege began, and the wildest rumors appeared from nowhere and swept through the town. Now, in the anxious quiet, crowds stormed General Hood's headquarters, demanding information. Crowds massed about the telegraph office and the depot, hoping for tidings, good tidings, for everyone hoped that the silence of Sherman's cannon meant that the Yankees were in full retreat, and the Confederates chasing them back up the road to Dalton. But no news came. The telegraph wires were still. No trains came in on the one remaining railroad from the south, and the mail service was broken. Autumn, with its dusty, breathless heat, was slipping into choke the suddenly quiet town, adding its dry, panting weight to tired, anxious hearts. To Scarlet, mad to hear from Tara, yet trying to keep up a brave face, it seemed an eternity since the siege began,
seemed as though she had always lived with the sound of cannon in her ears until this sinister quiet had fallen. And yet it was only 30 days since the siege began. 30 days of siege! The city ringed with red clay rifle pits, the monotonous booming of cannon that never rested, the long lines of ambulances and ox carts dripping blood down the dusty streets toward the hospitals, the overworked burial squads dragging out men when they were hardly cold, and dumping them like so many logs in endless rows of shallow ditches. Only 30 days! And it was only 4 months since the Yankees moved south from Dalton. Only 4 months! Scarlet thought, looking back on that far day, that it had occurred in another life. Oh, no! Surely not just 4 months. It had been a lifetime. 4 months ago. Why, 4 months ago, Dalton, Resaca, Kennesaw Mountain had been to her only names of places on the railroad. Now they were battles. Battles desperately, vainly fought as Johnston fell back toward Atlanta. And now, Peachtree Creek, Decatur, Ezra Church, and Utoy Creek were no longer pleasant names of pleasant places. Never again could she think of them as quiet villages full of welcoming friends, as green places where she picnicked with handsome officers on the soft banks of slow-moving streams. These names meant battles, too, and the soft green grasses where she had sat were cut to bits by heavy cannon wheels, trampled by desperate feet when bayonet met bayonet, and flattened where bodies threshed in agonies. And the lazy streams were redder now than ever Georgia clay could make them. Peachtree Creek was crimson, so they said, after the Yankees crossed it. Peachtree Creek, Decatur, Ezra Church, Utoy Creek. Never names of places any more. Names of graves where friends lay buried. Names of tangled underbrush and thick woods where bodies rotted unburied. Names of the four sides of Atlanta where Sherman had tried to force his army in, and Hood's men had doggedly beaten him back. At last, news came from the south to the strained town, and it was alarming news, especially to Scarlet. General Sherman was trying the fourth side of the town again, striking again at the railroad at Jonesboro. Yankees in large numbers were on that fourth side of the town now. No skirmishing units or cavalry detachments, but the massed Yankee forces. And thousands of Confederate troops had been withdrawn from the lines close about the city to hurl themselves against them. And that explained the sudden silence. Why Jonesboro? Thought Scarlet, terror striking at her heart at the thought of Tara's nearness. Why must they always hit Jonesboro? Why can't they find some other place to attack the railroad? For a week she hadn't heard from Tara, and the last brief note from Gerald had added to her fears. Corrine had taken a turn for the worse and was very, very sick. Now it might be days before the mails came through. Days before she heard whether Corrine was alive or dead. Oh, if she had only gone home at the beginning of the siege, Melanie or no Melanie. There was fighting at Jonesboro. That much Atlanta knew. But how the battle went, no one could tell, and the most insane rumors tortured the town. Finally, a courier came up from Jonesboro with the reassuring news that the Yankees had been beaten back. But they had made a sortie into Jonesboro, burned the depot, cut the telegraph wires, and torn up 3 miles of track before they retreated. The engineering corps was working like mad, repairing the line. But it would take some time, because the Yankees had torn up the cross ties, made bonfires of them, laid the wrenched-up rails across them until they were red hot, and then twisted them around telegraph poles until they looked like giant corkscrews. These days it was so hard to replace iron rails, to replace anything made of iron. No, The Yankees hadn't got to Terra. The same courier who brought the dispatches to General Hood assured Scarlet of that. He had met Gerald in Jonesboro after the battle, just as he was starting to Atlanta, and Gerald had begged him to bring a letter to her. But what was Paw doing in Jonesboro? The young courier looked ill at ease when he made answer. Gerald was hunting for an army doctor to go to Terra with him. As she stood in the sunshine on the front porch, thanking the young man for his trouble, Scarlet felt her knees go weak. Corrine must be dying if she was so far beyond Ellen's medical skill that Gerald was hunting a doctor. As the courier went off in a small whirlwind of red dust, Scarlet tore open Gerald's letter with fingers that trembled. So great was the shortage of paper in the Confederacy now that Gerald's note was written between the lines of her last letter to him, and reading it was difficult. "Dear daughter, your mother and both girls have the typhoid. They are very ill, but we must hope for the best. When your mother took to her bed, she bade me write you that under no condition were you to come home and expose yourself and wade to the disease. She sends her love and bids you pray for her."
Pray for her? Scarlet flew up the stairs to her room and, dropping on her knees by the bed, prayed as she had never prayed before. No formal rosaries now, but the same words over and over. "Mother of God, don't let her die. I'll be so good if you don't let her die. Please, don't let her die."
For the next week, Scarlet crept about the house like a stricken animal waiting for news. Starting at every sound of horses' hooves, rushing down the dark stair at night when soldiers came tapping at the door. But no news came from Terra. The width of the continent might have spread between her and home instead of 25 miles of dusty road. The mails were still disrupted. No one knew where the Confederates were or what the Yankees were up to. No one knew anything except that thousands of soldiers, gray and blue, were somewhere between Atlanta and Jonesboro. Not a word from Terra in a week. Scarlet had seen enough typhoid in the Atlanta hospital to know what a week meant in that dread disease. Ellen was ill, perhaps dying. And here was Scarlet, helpless in Atlanta, with a pregnant woman on her hands and two armies between her and home. Ellen was ill, perhaps dying. But Ellen couldn't be ill. She had never been ill. The very thought was incredible, and it struck at the very foundations of the security of Scarlet's life. Everyone else got sick, but never Ellen. Ellen looked after sick people and made them well again. She couldn't be sick. Scarlet wanted to be home. She wanted Terra with the desperate desire of a frightened child, frantic for the only haven it had ever known. Home. The sprawling white house with fluttering white curtains at the windows, the thick clover on the lawn with the bees busy in it, the little black boy on the front step shooing the ducks and turkeys from the flower beds, the serene red fields and the miles and miles of cotton turning white in the sun. Home. If she had only gone home at the beginning of the siege, when everyone else was refugeeing. She could have taken Melanie with her in safety with weeks to spare. Oh, damn Melanie, she thought a thousand times. Why couldn't she have gone to Macon with Aunt Pity? That's where she belongs, with her own kinfolks, not with me. I'm none of her blood. Why does she hang on to me so hard? If she'd only gone to Macon, then I could have gone home to Mother. Even now, I'd take a chance on getting home in spite of the Yankees if it wasn't for this baby. Maybe General Hood would give me an escort. He's a nice man, General Hood. And I know I could make him give me an escort and a flag of truce to get me through the lines. But I have to wait for this baby. Oh, Mother. Mother, don't die. Why don't this baby ever come?
I'll see Dr. Meade today and ask him if there's any way to hurry babies up so I can go home, if I can get an escort. Dr. Meade said she'd have a bad time. Dear God, suppose she should die. Melanie dead. And Ashley... No, I mustn't think about that. It isn't nice. But Ashley... No, I mustn't think about that because he's probably dead anyway. But he made me promise I'd take care of her. But if I didn't take care of her and she died and Ashley is still alive... No, I mustn't think about that. It's sinful. And I promised God I'd be good if he would just not let Mother die. Oh, if the baby would only come. If I could only get away from here, get home, get anywhere but here. Scarlett hated the sight of the ominously still town now. And once she had loved it. Atlanta was no longer the desperately gay place she had loved. It was a hideous place, like a plague-stricken city, so quiet, so dreadfully quiet, after the din of the siege. There had been stimulation in the noise and the danger of the shelling. There was only horror in the quiet that followed. The town seemed haunted. Haunted with fear and uncertainty and memories. People's faces looked pinched, and the few soldiers Scarlett saw wore the exhausted look of racers forcing themselves on through the last lap of a race already lost. The last day of August came, and with it convincing rumors that the fiercest fighting since the Battle of Atlanta was taking place somewhere to the south. Atlanta, waiting for the news of the turn of battle, stopped even trying to laugh and joke. Everyone knew now what the soldiers had known 2 weeks before, that Atlanta was in the last ditch, that if the Macon Railroad fell, Atlanta would fall too. On the morning of the 1st of September, Scarlett awoke with a suffocating sense of dread upon her, a dread she had taken to her pillow the night before. She thought, dulled with sleep. What was it I was worrying about when I went to bed last night? Oh, yes, the fighting. There was a battle somewhere yesterday. Oh, who won? She sat up hastily, rubbing her eyes, and her worried heart took up yesterday's load again. The air was oppressive even in the early morning hour, hot with the scorching promise of a noon of glaring blue sky and pitiless bronze sun. The road outside lay silent. No wagons creaked by. No troops raised the red dust with their tramping feet. There were no sounds of Negroes' lazy voices in neighboring kitchens. No pleasant sounds of breakfasts being prepared. For all the near neighbors, except Mrs. Meade and Mrs. Merriweather, had refugeed to Macon. And she could hear nothing from their houses, either. Farther down the street, the business section was quiet, and many of the stores and offices were locked and boarded up, while their occupants were somewhere about the countryside with rifles in their hands. The stillness that greeted her seemed even more sinister this morning than on any of the mornings of the queer quiet week preceding it. She rose hastily, without her usual preliminary burrowings and stretchings, and went to the window, hoping to see some neighbor's face, some heartening sight. But the road was empty. She noted how the leaves on the trees were still dark green but dry, and heavily coated with red dust, and how withered and sad the untended flowers in the front yard looked. As she stood, looking out of the window, there came to her ears a far-off sound, faint and sullen as the first distant thunder of an approaching storm. Rain, she thought in the first moment, and her country-bred mind added, "We certainly need it." But in a split instant, rain. No, not rain. Cannon. Her heart racing, she leaned from the window, her ear caught to the far-off roaring, trying to discover from which direction it came. But the dim thundering was so distant that for a moment she couldn't tell. "Make it from Marietta, Lord," she prayed, "or Decatur, or Peachtree Creek, but not from the south, not from the south." She gripped the window sill tighter and strained her ears, and the faraway booming seemed louder. And it was coming from the south. Cannon to the south. And to the south lay Jonesboro and Tara. And Ellen. Yankees, perhaps, at Tara, now, this minute. She listened again, but the blood thudding in her ears all but blurred out the sound of far-off firing. No, they couldn't be at Jonesboro yet. If they were that far away, the sound would be fainter, more indistinct. But they must be at least 10 miles down the road toward Jonesboro, probably near the little settlement of Rough and Ready. But Jonesboro was scarcely more than 10 miles below Rough and Ready. Cannon to the south. And they might be tolling the knell of Atlanta's fall. But to Scarlet, sick for her mother's safety, fighting to the south only meant fighting near Terra. She walked the floor and wrung her hands, and for the first time the thought in all its implications came to her that the Gray Army might be defeated. It was the thought of Sherman's thousands so close to Terra that brought it all home to her, brought the full horror of the war to her, as no sound of siege guns shattering window panes, no privations of food and clothing, and no endless rows of dying men had done. Sherman's army, within a few miles of Tara. And even if the Yankees should be defeated, they might fall back down the road to Tara. And Gerald couldn't possibly refugee out of their way with 3 sick women. Oh, if she were only there now, Yankees or not! She paced the floor in her bare feet, her nightgown clinging to her legs, and the more she walked, the stronger became her foreboding. She wanted to be at home. She wanted to be near Ellen. From the kitchen below, she heard the rattle of china as Prissy prepared breakfast, but no sound of Mrs. Meade's Betsy. The shrill, melancholy minor of Prissy was raised.
"Just a few more days to tote the weary load,"
the song grated on Scarlet, its sad implications frightening her, and slipping on a wrapper, she pattered out into the hall and to the back stairs and shouted, "Shut up that singin', Prissy!" A sullen, "Yes'm," drifted up to her as she drew a deep breath, feeling suddenly ashamed of herself.
"Where's Betsy?"
"I don't know. She ain't came."
Scarlet walked to Melanie's door and opened it a crack, peering into the sunny room. Melanie lay in bed in her nightgown, her eyes closed and circled with black, her heart-shaped face bloated, her slender body hideous and distorted. Scarlet wished viciously that Ashley could see her now. She looked worse than any pregnant woman she had ever seen. As she looked, Melanie's eyes opened, and a soft, warm smile lit her face. "Come in," she invited, turning awkwardly on her side. "I've been awake since sunup, thinking, and Scarlet, there's something I want to ask you." She entered the room and sat down on the bed that was glaring with harsh sunshine. Melanie reached out and took Scarlet's hand in a gentle, confiding clasp. "Dear," she said, "I'm sorry about the cannon. It's toward Jonesboro, isn't it?" Scarlet said, her heart beginning to beat faster as the thought recurred. "I know how worried you are. I know you'd have gone home last week when you heard about your mother, if it hadn't been for me. Wouldn't you?" "Yes," said Scarlet ungraciously. "Scarlet, darling, you've been so good to me. No sister could have been sweeter or braver. And I love you for it. I'm so sorry I'm in the way." Scarlet stared. Loved her, did she? The fool. And Scarlet, I've been lying here thinking, and I want to ask a very great favor of you. Her clasp tightened. If I should die, will you take my baby? Melanie's eyes were wide and bright with soft urgency. Will you? Scarlet jerked away her hand as fear swamped her. Fear roughened her voice as she spoke. Oh, don't be a goose, Melly. You aren't going to die. Every woman thinks she's going to die with her first baby. I know I did. No, you didn't. You've never been afraid of anything. You're just saying that to try to cheer me up. I'm not afraid to die. But I'm so afraid to leave the baby if Ashley is... Scarlet, promise me that you'll take my baby if I should die. Then I won't be afraid. Aunt Pittypat is too old to raise a child, and Honey and India are sweet, but I want you to have my baby. Promise me, Scarlet. And if it's a boy, bring him up like Ashley. And if it's a girl, dear, I'd like her to be like you. God's nightgown, cried Scarlet, leaping from the bed. Aren't things bad enough without you talking about dying? I'm sorry, dear, but promise me. I think it'll be today. I'm sure it'll be today. Please promise me. Oh, all right, I promise, said Scarlet, looking down at her in bewilderment. Was Melanie such a fool she really didn't know how she cared for Ashley? Or did she know everything and feel that because of that love, Scarlet would take good care of Ashley's child? Scarlet had a wild impulse to cry out questions, but they died on her lips as Melanie took her hand and held it for an instant against her cheek. Tranquility had come back into her eyes. Why do you think it'll be today, Melly? I've been having pain since dawn, but not very bad ones. You have? Well, why didn't you call me? I'll send Prissy for Dr. Mead. No, don't do that yet, Scarlet. You know how busy he is, how busy they all are. Just send word to him that we'll need him sometime today. Send over to Mrs. Mead's and tell her and ask her to come over and sit with me. She'll know when to really send for him. Oh, stop being so unselfish. You know you need a doctor as much as anybody in the hospital. I'll send for him right away. No, please don't. Sometimes it takes all day having a baby, and I just couldn't let the doctor sit here for hours when all those poor boys need him so much. Just send for Mrs. Mead. She'll know. Oh, all right, said Scarlet.
Chapter 21. After sending up Melanie's breakfast tray, Scarlet dispatched Prissy for Mrs. Mead and sat down with Wade to eat her own breakfast. But for once she had no appetite. Between her nervous apprehension over the thought that Melanie's time was approaching and her unconscious straining to hear the sound of the cannon, she could hardly eat. Her heart acted very queerly, beating regularly for several minutes, and then thumping so loudly and swiftly, it almost made her sick at her stomach. The heavy hominy stuck in her throat like glue, and never before had the mixture of parched corn and ground-up yams that passed for coffee been so repulsive. Without sugar or cream, it was bitter as gall, for the sorghum used for long sweetening did little to improve the taste. After one swallow, she pushed her cup away. If for no other reason, she hated the Yankees because they kept her from having real coffee with sugar and thick cream in it. Wade was quieter than usual, and didn't set up his every morning complaint against the hominy that he so disliked. He ate silently the spoonfuls she pushed into his mouth and washed them down with noisily gulp to water. His soft brown eyes followed her every movement, large, round as dollars, a childish bewilderment in them, as though her own scarce hidden fears had been communicated to him. When he had finished, she sent him off to the backyard to play, and watched him toddle across the straggling grass to his playhouse with great relief. She arose and stood irresolutely at the foot of the stairs. She should go up and sit with Melanie and distract her mind from her coming ordeal, but she didn't feel equal to it. Of all the days in the world, Melanie had to pick this day to have the baby. And of all days to talk about dying. She sat down on the bottom step of the stairs and tried to compose herself, wondering again how yesterday's battle had gone, wondering how today's fighting was going. How strange to have a big battle going on just a few miles away and to know nothing of it. How strange the quiet of this deserted end of town in contrast with the day of the fighting at Peachtree Creek. Aunt Pitty's house was one of the last on the north side of Atlanta, and with the fighting somewhere to the far south, there were no reinforcements going by at double quick, no ambulances and staggering lines of walking wounded coming back. She wondered if such scenes were being enacted on the south side of town, and thanked God she wasn't there. If only everyone except the Meads and the Merriweathers had not refugeed from this north end of Peachtree. It made her feel so forsaken and alone. She wished fervently that Uncle Peter were with her, so he could go down to the headquarters and learn the news. If it wasn't for Melanie, she'd go to town this very minute and learn for herself. But she couldn't leave until Mrs. Mead arrived. Mrs. Mead, why didn't she come on? And where was Prissy? She rose and went out onto the front porch and looked for them impatiently. But the Mead house was around a shady bend in the street, and she could see no one. After a long while, Prissy came into view, alone, idling along as though she had the whole day before her, switching her skirts from side to side and looking over her shoulder to observe the effect. "You're as slow as molasses in January," snapped Scarlet, as Prissy opened the gate. "What did Mrs. Mead say? How soon will she be over here?"
"She weren't there," said Prissy.
"Where is she? When will she be home?"
"Well'm,"
answered Prissy, dragging out her words pleasurably to give more weight to a message.
"Their cookie said Miss Mead done got word early this morning that young Mr. Phil done been shot. And Miss Mead, she took the cadge, and old Talbot, and Betsy, and they done gone to fetch him home. Cookie say he bad hurt, and Miss Mead ain't gwine to be studying about coming up here."
Scarlet stared at her, and had an impulse to shake her. Negroes were always so proud of being the bearers of evil tidings. "Well, don't stand there like a ninny. Go down to Mrs. Merriweather's and ask her to come up or send her mammy. Now hurry!"
"They ain't there, Miss Scarlet. I dropped in to pass the time of day with mammy on my way home. They's done gone. House all locked up. Spec they's at the hospital."
"So that's where you were so long. Whenever I send you somewhere, you go where I tell you and don't stop to pass any time with anybody. Go!"
She stopped and racked her brain. Who was left in town among their friends who would be helpful? There was Mrs. Elsing. Of course, Mrs. Elsing didn't like her at all these days, but she had always been fond of Melanie. "Go to Mrs. Elsing's and explain everything very carefully and tell her to please come up here. And Prissy, listen to me. Miss Melly's baby is due, and she may need you any minute now. Now you hurry right straight back."
"Yes'm,"
said Prissy, and turning, sauntered down the walk at Snail's gate.
"Hurry, you slowpoke!"
"Yes'm."
Prissy quickened her gait infinitesimally, and Scarlet went back into the house. She hesitated again before going upstairs to Melanie. She would have to explain to her just why Mrs. Mead couldn't come, and the knowledge that Phil Mead was badly wounded might upset her. Well, she'd tell a lie about it. She entered Melanie's room and saw that the breakfast tray was untouched. Melanie lay on her side, her face white.
"Mrs. Meade's over at the hospital," said Scarlett. "But Mrs. Elsing is coming. Do you feel bad?"
"Not very," lied Melanie.
"Scarlett, how long did it take Wade to get born?"
"Less than no time,"
answered Scarlett with a cheerfulness she was far from feeling.
"I was out in the yard, and I didn't hardly have time to get into the house. Mammy said it was scandalous, just like one of the darkies."
"I hope I'll be like one of the darkies, too,"
said Melanie, mustering a smile which suddenly disappeared as pain contorted her face. Scarlett looked down at Melanie's tiny hips with none too sanguine hopes, but said reassuringly,
"Oh, it's not really so bad."
"Oh, I know it isn't. I'm afraid I'm a little coward. Is Mrs. Elsing coming right away?"
"Yes, right away," said Scarlett. "I'll go down and get some fresh water and sponge you off. It's so hot today."
She took as long a time as possible in getting the water, running to the front door every 2 minutes to see if Prissy were coming. There was no sign of Prissy, so she went back upstairs, sponged Melanie's perspiring body, and combed out her long dark hair. When an hour had passed, she heard scuffing Negro feet coming down the street, and looking out of the window, saw Prissy returning slowly, switching herself as before and tossing her head with as many airy affectations as if she had a large and interested audience.
"Some day I'm going to take a strap to that little wench," thought Scarlett savagely, hurrying down the stairs to meet her.
"Miss Elsing over at the hospital. Dey cookie loves a whole lot of wounded soldiers coming on the early train. Cookie fixing soup to take over there. She say—"
"Never mind what she said," interrupted Scarlett, her heart sinking. "Put on a clean apron, because I want you to go over to the hospital. I'm going to give you a note to Dr. Meade, and if he isn't there, give it to Dr. Jones, or any of the other doctors. And if you don't hurry back this time, I'll skin you alive."
"Yes'm."
"And ask any of the gentlemen for news of the fighting. If they don't know, go by the depot and ask the engineers who brought the wounded in. Ask if they're fighting at Jonesboro or near there."
"God almighty, Miss Scarlett!"
And sudden fright was in Prissy's black face.
"The Yankees ain't a terror, is they?"
"I don't know. I'm telling you to ask for news."
"God almighty, Miss Scarlett! What'll they do tomorrow?"
Prissy began to bawl suddenly, loudly, the sound adding to Scarlett's own uneasiness.
"Stop bawling. Miss Melanie will hear you. Now go change your apron quick."
Spurred to speed, Prissy hurried toward the back of the house while Scarlett scratched a hasty note on the margin of Gerald's last letter to her, the only bit of paper in the house. As she folded it, so that her note was uppermost, she caught Gerald's words.
"Your mother. Typhoid. Under no condition to come home."
She almost sobbed. If it wasn't for Melanie, she'd start home right this minute, if she had to walk every step of the way. Prissy went off at a trot, the letter gripped in her hand, and Scarlett went back upstairs, trying to think of some plausible lie to explain Mrs. Elsing's failure to appear. But Melanie asked no questions. She lay upon her back, her face tranquil and sweet, and the sight of her quieted Scarlett for a while. She sat down and tried to talk of inconsequential things, but the thoughts of terror and a possible defeat by the Yankees prodded cruelly. She thought of Ellen dying, and of the Yankees coming into Atlanta, burning everything, killing everybody. Through it all, the dull, far-off thundering persisted, rolling into her ears in waves of fear. Finally, She couldn't talk at all and only stared out of the window at the hot, still street and the dusty leaves hanging motionless on the trees. Melanie was silent, too, but at intervals her quiet face was wrenched with pain. She said, after each pain, "It wasn't very bad, really." And Scarlett knew she was lying. She would have preferred a loud scream to silent endurance. She knew she should feel sorry for Melanie, but somehow she could not muster a spark of sympathy. Her mind was too torn with her own anguish. Once she looked sharply at the pain-twisted face and wondered why it should be that she, of all people in the world, should be here with Melanie at this particular time. She who had nothing in common with her, who hated her, who would gladly have seen her dead. Well, maybe she'd have her wish, and before the day was over, too. A cold, superstitious fear swept her at this thought. It was bad luck to wish that someone were dead. Almost as bad luck as to curse someone. Curses came home to roost, Mammy said. She hastily prayed that Melanie wouldn't die, and broke into feverish small talk, hardly aware of what she said. At last, Melanie put a hot hand on her wrist. "Don't bother about talking, dear. I know how worried you are. I'm so sorry I am so much trouble." Scarlett relapsed into silence, but she could not sit still. What would she do if neither the doctor nor Prissy got there in time? She walked to the window and looked down the street and came back and sat down again. Then she rose and looked out of the window on the other side of the room. An hour went by, and then another. Noon came, and the sun was high and hot, and not a breath of air stirred the dusty leaves. Melanie's pains were harder now. Her long hair was drenched in sweat, and her gown stuck in wet spots to her body. Scarlett sponged her face in silence, but fear was gnawing at her. God in heaven! Suppose the baby came before the doctor arrived. What would she do? She knew less than nothing of midwifery. This was exactly the emergency she had been dreading for weeks. She had been counting on Prissy to handle the situation if no doctor should be available. Prissy knew all about midwifery. She'd said so time and again. But where was Prissy? Why didn't she come? Why didn't the doctor come? She went to the window and looked again. She listened hard, and suddenly she wondered if it were only her imagination or if the sound of cannon in the distance had died away. If it were farther away, it would mean that the fighting was nearer Jonesboro, and that would mean... At last she saw Prissy coming down the street at a quick trot, and she leaned out of the window. Prissy, looking up, saw her, and her mouth opened to yell. Seeing the panic written on the little black face and fearing she might alarm Melanie by crying out evil tidings, Scarlett hastily put her finger to her lips and left the window. "I'll get some cooler water," she said, looking down into Melanie's dark, deep-circled eyes and trying to smile. Then she hastily left the room, closing the door carefully behind her. Prissy was sitting on the bottom step in the hall, panting.
"Dey's fightin' at Jonesboro, Miss Scarlett. Dey say our gentmans is gettin' beat. Oh, God, Miss Scarlett, what'll happen to Ma and Polk? Oh, God, Miss Scarlett, what'll happen to us if the Yankees get here? Oh, God!"
Scarlett clapped a hand over the blubbery mouth.
"For God's sake, hush!"
"Yes. What would happen to them if the Yankees came? What would happen to Tara?" She pushed the thought firmly back into her mind and grappled with the more pressing emergency. If she thought of these things, she began to scream and bawl like Prissy.
"Where's Dr. Meade? When's he coming?" "I ain't never seed him, Miss Scarlett."
"What?"
"No, he ain't at the hospital. Miss Meriwether and Miss Elsing ain't there neither. A man... he told me the doctor down by the car shed with the wounded soldiers just come in from Jonesboro, but, Miss Scarlett, I was scared to go down there to the shed.
There's folkses dying down there. I'm scared of dead folkses.
What about the other doctors?
Miss Scarlet, for God, I couldn't scarcely get one of them to read your note. They walking in the hospital like they all done gone crazy. One doctor, he said to me, "Damn your hide, don't you come round here bothering me about babies when we got a mess of men dying here. Get some women to help you." And then I went around and about and asked the folks news like you done told me, and they all say fighting at Jonesboro, and I...
You say Dr. Meade's at the depot?
Yes'm.
He... Now listen sharp to me. I'm going to get Dr. Meade, and I want you to sit by Miss Melanie and do anything she says. And if you so much as breathe to her where the fighting is, I'll sell you south as sure as guns iron. And don't you tell her that the other doctors wouldn't come either. Do you hear?
Yes'm.
Wipe your eyes and get a fresh pitcher of water and go on up. Sponge her off. Tell her I've gone for Dr. Meade.
Is it time now, Miss Scarlet?
I don't know. I'm afraid it is, but I don't know. You should know. Go on up. Scarlet caught up her wide straw bonnet from the console table and jammed it on her head. She looked in the mirror and automatically pushed up loose strands of hair, but she didn't see her own reflection. Cold little ripples of fear that started in the pit of her stomach were radiating outward until the fingers that touched her cheeks were cold, though the rest of her body streamed perspiration. She hurried out of the house and into the heat of the sun. It was blindingly, glaringly hot, and as she hurried down Peachtree Street, her temples began to throb from the heat. From far down the street, she could hear the rise and fall and roar of many voices. By the time she caught sight of the Layden house, she was beginning to pant, for her stays were tightly laced. But she didn't slow her gait. The roar of noise grew louder. From the Layden house down to Five Points, the streets seethed with activity, the activity of an anthill just destroyed. Negroes were running up and down the street, panic in their faces, and on porches, white children sat crying untended. The street was crowded with army wagons and ambulances filled with wounded and carriages piled high with valises and pieces of furniture. Men on horseback dashed out of side streets pell-mell, down Peachtree Street toward Hood's headquarters. In front of the Bunnell house, old Amos stood holding the head of the carriage horse, and he greeted Scarlet with rolling eyes.
"Ain't you gone yet, Miss Scarlet? We is going now. Old Miss packing a bag."
"Going? Where?"
"God knows, Miss. Somewheres. The Yankees is coming."
She hurried on, not even saying goodbye. The Yankees were coming. At Wesley Chapel, she paused to catch her breath and wait for her hammering heart to subside. If she didn't quiet herself, she would certainly faint. As she stood clutching a lamppost for support, she saw an officer on horseback come charging up the street from Five Points, and on an impulse she ran out into the street and waved at him.
"Oh, stop! Please stop!"
He reined in so suddenly the horse went back on its haunches, pawing the air. There were harsh lines of fatigue and urgency in his face, but his tattered gray hat was off with a sweep.
"Madam?"
"Tell me, is it true? Are the Yankees coming?"
"I'm afraid so."
"Do you know so?"
"Yes, ma'am, I know so. A dispatch came into headquarters half an hour ago from the fighting at Jonesboro."
"At Jonesboro? Are you sure?"
"I'm sure. There's no use telling pretty lies, madam. The message was from General Hardee, and it said, 'I have lost the battle and am in full retreat.'"
"Oh, my God!"
The dark face of the tired man looked down without emotion. He gathered the reins again and put on his hat.
"Oh, sir, please, just a minute. What shall we do?"
"Madam, I can't say. The army is evacuating Atlanta soon."
going off and leaving us to the Yankees?
I'm afraid so.
The spurred horse went off as though on springs, and Scarlet was left standing in the middle of the street with the red dust thick upon her ankles. The Yankees were coming. The army was leaving. The Yankees were coming. What should she do? Where should she run? No, she couldn't run. There was Melanie back there in the bed expecting that baby. Oh, why did women have babies? If it wasn't for Melanie, she could take Wade and Prissy and hide in the woods where the Yankees could never find them. But she couldn't take Melanie to the woods. No, not now. Oh, if she'd only had the baby sooner, yesterday even. Perhaps they could get an ambulance and take her away and hide her somewhere. But now... she must find Dr. Meade and make him come home with her. Perhaps he could hurry the baby. She gathered up her skirts and ran down the street, and the rhythm of her feet was, "The Yankees are coming! The Yankees are coming!" Five Points was crowded with people who rushed here and there with unseeing eyes, jammed with wagons, ambulances, ox carts, carriages loaded with wounded. A roaring sound like the breaking of surf rose from the crowd. Then a strangely incongruous sight struck her eyes. Throngs of women were coming up from the direction of the railroad tracks, carrying hams across their shoulders. Little children hurried by their sides, staggering under buckets of steaming molasses. Young boys dragged sacks of corn and potatoes. One old man struggled along with a small barrel of flour on a wheelbarrow. Men, women, and children, black and white, hurried with straining faces, lugging packages and sacks and boxes of food, more food than she had seen in a year. The crowd suddenly gave a lane for a careening carriage, and through the lane came the frail and elegant Mrs. Elsing, standing up in the front of her Victoria, reins in one hand, whip in the other. She was hatless and white-faced, and her long gray hair streamed down her back as she lashed the horse like a fury. Jouncing on the back seat of the carriage was her black mammy, Melissy, clutching a greasy side of bacon to her with one hand, while with the other and both feet she attempted to hold the boxes and bags piled all about her. One bag of dried peas had burst, and the peas strewed themselves into the street. Scarlet screamed to her, but the tumult of the crowd drowned her voice, and the carriage rocked madly by. For a moment, she couldn't understand what it all meant, and then, remembering that the commissary warehouses were down by the railroad tracks, she realized that the army had thrown them open to the people to salvage what they could before the Yankees came. She pushed her way swiftly through the crowds, past the packed, hysterical mob surging in the open space of Five Points, and hurried as fast as she could down the short block toward the depot. Through the tangle of ambulances and the clouds of dust, she could see doctors and stretcher-bearers bending, lifting, hurrying. Thank God, she'd find Dr. Meade soon. As she rounded the corner of the Atlanta Hotel and came in full view of the depot and the tracks, she halted, appalled. Lying in the pitiless sun, shoulder to shoulder, head to feet, were hundreds of wounded men, lining the tracks, the sidewalks, stretched out in endless rows under the car shed. Some lay stiff and still, but many writhed under the hot sun, moaning. Everywhere, swarms of flies hovered over the men, crawling and buzzing in their faces. Everywhere was blood, dirty bandages, groans, screamed curses of pain as stretcher-bearers lifted men. The smell of sweat, of blood, of unwashed bodies, of excrement rose up in waves of blistering heat until the fetid stench almost nauseated her. The ambulance men hurrying here and there among the prostrate forms frequently stepped on wounded men, so thickly packed were the rows. And those trodden upon stared stolidly up, waiting their turn. She shrank back, clapping her hand to her mouth, feeling that she was going to vomit. She couldn't go on. She had seen wounded men in the hospitals, wounded men on Aunt Pity's lawn after the fighting at the creek. But never anything like this. Never anything like these stinking, bleeding bodies broiling under the glaring sun. This was an inferno of pain and smell and noise and hurry. Hurry! Hurry! The Yankees are coming! The Yankees are coming! She braced her shoulders and went down among them, straining her eyes among the upright figures to distinguish Dr. Meade. But she discovered she could not look for him, for if she didn't step carefully, she would tread on some poor soldier. She raised her skirts and tried to pick her way among them toward a knot of men who were directing the stretcher-bearers. As she walked, feverish hands plucked at her skirt and voices croaked, "Lady, water! Please, lady, water! For Christ's sake, water!" Perspiration came down her face in streams as she pulled her skirts from clutching hands. If she stepped on one of these men, she'd scream and faint. She stepped over dead men, over men who lay dull-eyed with hands clutched to bellies where dried blood had glued torn uniforms to wounds, over men whose beards were stiff with blood and from whose broken jaws came sounds which must mean water, water. If she didn't find Dr. Meade soon, she would begin screaming with hysteria. She looked toward the group of men under the car shed and cried as loudly as she could, "Dr. Meade! Is Dr. Meade there?" From the group, one man detached himself and looked toward her. It was the doctor. He was coatless, and his sleeves were rolled up to his shoulders. His shirt and trousers were as red as a butcher's, and even the end of his iron-gray beard was matted with blood. His face was the face of a man drunk with fatigue and impotent rage and burning pity. It was gray and dusty, and sweat had streaked long rivulets across his cheeks. But his voice was calm and decisive as he called to her, "Thank God you are here. I can use every pair of hands." For a moment she stared at him, bewildered, dropping her skirts in dismay. They fell over the dirty face of a wounded man who feebly tried to turn his head to escape from their smothering folds. What did the doctor mean? The dust from the ambulances came into her face with choking dryness, and the rotten smells were like a foul liquid in her nostrils. "Hurry, child, come here." She picked up her skirts and went to him as fast as she could go across the rows of bodies. She put her hand on his arm and felt that it was trembling with weariness. But there was no weakness in his face. "Oh, doctor," she cried, "you must come. Melanie is having a baby." He looked at her as if the words did not register on his mind. A man who lay upon the ground at her feet, his head pillowed on his canteen, grinned up companionably at her words. "They will do it," he said cheerfully. She didn't even look down, but shook the doctor's arm. "It's Melanie, the baby. Doctor, you must come. This was no time for delicacy, but it was hard to bring out the words with the ears of hundreds of strange men listening. "The pains are getting hard. Please, doctor." "A baby? Great God!" thundered the doctor, and his face was suddenly contorted with hate and rage. A rage not directed at her or at anyone except a world wherein such things could happen. "Are you crazy? I can't leave these men. They are dying, hundreds of them. I can't leave them for a damn baby. Get some woman to help you. Get my wife." She opened her mouth to tell him why Mrs. Meade couldn't come, and then shut it abruptly. He didn't know his own son was wounded. She wondered if he would still be here if he did know. And something told her that even if Phil were dying, he would still be standing on this spot, giving aid to the many instead of the one. "No, you must come, doctor. You know you said she'd have a hard time." Was it really she, Scarlet, standing here saying these dreadful, indelicate things at the top of her voice in this hell of heat and groans?
She'll die if you don't come.
He shook off her hand roughly and spoke as though he hardly heard her, hardly knew what she said.
Die? Yes, they'll all die, all these men,